Welcome to What She Said on 105.9 The Region. I'm your host, Candace Sampson. As we continue to sail through April and with Earth Month halfway over, our focus on sustainability and environmental stewardship has never been more critical. Amidst the blossoming of spring and the promise of warmer days, this week's show is dedicated to exploring impactful topics that resonate with the essence of this vibrant month. From the ongoing battle for pay equity to the innovative strides in eco-fashion, we're diving deep into discussions that matter. And as we navigate through these discussions, let's remember the power of individual action in shaping a healthier planet and a more equitable society. So grab your favorite beverage and let's get into an hour of enlightening and uplifting dialogue. Here's what's coming up on this week's show. In today's top interview, we're looking into the persistent issue of the gender wage gap with Commissioner Katie Philp from the Pay Equity Office of Ontario. As part of our ongoing six-part series, we're exploring the nuances of pay equity and its impact on women across the province. Katie is here to provide insights into the challenges and solutions surrounding this critical topic, offering guidance on how we can all contribute to narrowing the gap. Anne Brody brings us the latest in entertainment, highlighting the much-anticipated Civil War, the greatest hits on Disney+, the compelling drama Franklin on Apple TV+, starring Michael Douglas, and the breathtaking Our Living World on Netflix, narrated by the incomparable Cate Blanchett. Anne's expertise is sure to guide us to our next favorite watch. In keeping with the show's focus on Earth Month, we then turn our attention to the pressing issue of food waste with Punita Chitwal Varma, author of Good Food, Healthy Planet. Punita is set to share practical strategies for reducing our food waste footprint, emphasizing the significant environmental benefits that can arise from mindful consumption and waste reduction. Sustainable fashion takes center stage as I chat with Cynthia Savard, the visionary behind Oriki. Cynthia's commitment to eco-conscious apparel production is redefining the fashion industry, proving that style and sustainability can go hand in hand. We'll dive into the innovative practices that make Oriki a leader in sustainable fashion and discuss the importance of transparency in combating greenwashing and fast fashion. Closing out the show, Suzanne Duncan from the Canadian Women's Foundation joins me to talk about the Count Me In initiative, a crucial campaign aimed at advancing gender equality in Canada. Suzanne will shed light on the barriers still faced by women and gender-diverse individuals and how we can all play a part in creating a more inclusive and equitable society. Stay tuned for an hour of engaging conversations that promise to inspire, inform, and ignite action. Right here on 105.9 The Region. I'm excited to be continuing our six-part series in partnership with the Pay Equity Office of Ontario, right here on What She Said. Last month, we looked at the history and purpose of Ontario's Pay Equity Office, and there's much more to come, including a look at pay equity versus equal pay, for equal work, the gender pension gap, and the intricacies of employment law for women. Today, though, we're honing in on the gender wage gap, a topic that affects countless individuals across the province and beyond. Joining me once again is Commissioner Katie Philp, here to shed light on this pressing issue. Welcome back to What She Said, Katie.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So let's dive straight into the heart of the matter. Can you paint us a picture of the current landscape of the gender wage gap in Canada and Ontario, where we stand, and how has the situation evolved over recent years?
Sure. And I'm going to start, Candace, with some good news for your listeners and your audience. So the good news is the hourly wage gap has actually narrowed from 6 to 13 percentage points across all provinces since 1998. So that's great news. But to give you an example, you know, in Ontario alone, it's narrowed 6 percentage points since 1998 to 13%, which is the current gender wage gap in Ontario when we look at average hourly wages. And we'll talk later about the different metrics that you can use and why those different metrics give us different numbers. But I think your listeners will find it interesting that, you know, across the province, I'm going to use average hourly wage right now, but Ontario comes in about sixth place at 13%. And Saskatchewan and Newfoundland and Labrador are also at 13%. Prince Edward Island is the lowest in the country at 4%. New Brunswick, 8%. Nova Scotia, 8%. Quebec, 10%. Manitoba, 11%. And actually, the gender wage gap is the highest in Alberta and British Columbia at 17%. Maybe not a coincidence that neither of them have any sort of legislation that addresses pay equity. But the average hourly gender wage gap across Canada is 13%. So Ontario is on par with the Canadian average. So is Saskatchewan and Newfoundland and Labrador. We know, you know, without getting into details here, but we know that the gender wage gap is larger for racialized women and women who are newcomers, women with disabilities, Indigenous women. And we need better data to really understand the breadth and depth of the problem. We just started collecting more intersectional data at Stats Canada and through other organizations. But we know in some part that it's linked to part of what I talked about last, our last conversation, to historical biases and stereotype of the types of bodies that we value at work.
And the I'm happy to hear, of course, obviously, that the gender wage gap is closing. What's driving this change? Are there specific initiatives or societal shifts that are contributing to narrowing the gap?
It's a good question, because when we look at why or understand why it's closing, we can think about, okay, what can we do to continue those trends, to continue to close the gender wage gap? We know certain, you know, really measurable things, like women have an increased educational attainment. So one of the reasons for paying women in the labor market, you know, a long time ago is that they had less education. They also had less access to education, but we'll just leave that aside. That's a different conversation. But women's increased attainment of education has really been a key factor to closing the gender wage gap, because they're coming out with higher credentials, which need to be rewarded and compensated for fairly in the labor market. Also, the distribution of men and women across different occupations are changing. So we talked a little bit about before, and listeners, if they missed it, can listen to the episode. We talked about the clustering of women and men into certain types of jobs. And it was very binary at that time, where it was men's work and women's work. And that sort of persistent clustering is starting to dismantle a bit. So we have women moving into higher paying sectors, and this kind of breaking down of the very strict, rigid, gender-based job classification system, which is, in fact, a really, really great thing. And so these are some of the things that are starting to close the gap. We can get into, you know, later on why it's persisting and what some of those reasons are. But we're seeing, you know, these trends in women getting education, getting compensated for it, and moving into and dismantling this clustering practice.
And you mentioned sort of in the beginning that, you know, measuring the gender wage gap, it seems pretty complex from the outside looking in. So can you help demystify this a bit? How exactly is that gender wage gap calculated, and what factors are considered in this equation?
So it is really complicated. And thank you for asking that question, because I hear numbers thrown around all the time. I'm like, that's not a wage gap, but okay. So it's typically measured in four different metrics. And I'm not going to, you know, bring your listeners through a statistics lesson here, but the four measures you'll see are average hourly wages, median hourly wages, average annual earnings, and median annual earnings. And so, you know, just to say, regardless of whatever of the four metrics you're using, the wage gap persists no matter how it's measured. But the average hourly, and it's what we often use, this measure is, I would say, less affected by gender differences in work. So we know that women tend to work less hours than men for a whole host of reasons, which could be another episode. But this is a participation gap, essentially, right? Higher expectations for unpaid care work or work or family responsibilities, domestic work. This causes women to work less. And so this is an earnings gap. So this is what the average annual earnings would cover. So the average hourly is the hourly wage men and women get. It doesn't account for this sort of difference in the actual hours worked. Average annual gives us a bigger picture of sort of the economic well-being of women in the labor market, because it really reflects the full scope of the financial implications of the sort of gendered expectations of women in the labor market and their participation in the labor market, and what that is reflected in earnings. So obviously, you know, if women are working less hours because of all of these other sort of social, cultural, religious expectations, they're going to have a lot less average annual earnings. And you see that reflected. Like, for instance, in Ontario, the gender wage gap, as I said, by the hourly average is 13%. But when you look at average annual earnings, it's up to 25%, because that accounts for the less hours worked. And that's different than the gender wage gap. That's a reflection of the broader labor market dynamics and gendered dynamics of the labor market. But it's important because it shows the economic impact this has on women, which is certainly an important metric to be looking at, the financial well-being of women in the labor market.
So, you know, this is where we reach the part of the interview that gets me really fired up, because this still persists. You've been around since 1987.
Yeah.
You know, as we discussed in the last episode, you know, we've been fighting this for a while, long before even the Pay Equity Commission even came into being. We've been fighting for this, quality, mm-hmm. equity. So from your perspective, what are the root causes that continue to fuel this disparity? And more importantly, what steps can we take to address these underlying issues?
Well, part of it, and you know, I'll push your listeners back to the episode we talked about, because I don't have time to go into the history of the labor market here, but we're still dealing with legacy, right? We had laws that prescribed what type of work women and men could do, and limited women's ability to participate in labor market and defined certain roles for them in a paid labor market. So the legacy of that, if you have, you know, legislation or social, cultural, religious practices that have persisted for, you know, a couple hundred years or thousands, but I mean, when we're talking about paid labor market, we're talking about the Industrial Revolution. So a couple of hundred years, it takes time to dismantle those biases. So as I mentioned in our last episode, those laws, most of them in at least North America have been, you know, dismissed, but there's still that legacy that's in place. So, you know, a couple of broader things though, and things where we can start to take action more immediately to make the difference is, you know, it persists because women need to or choose to leave and re-enter the workforce in order to meet family caregiving responsibilities. So this is obviously, you know, in many ways a woman's choice, and we should applaud and support that as well. But we should also consider if women don't want to do that, or if they need supports to do that, right? Like, you know, you've talked a lot about being a single mother and the responsibilities and the challenges that that creates. And if there's no social structures around it, or if we don't value women's participation, then we don't build structures to support that. So we have to think of some of these assumptions, especially the assumption of choice for women, because it's not always choice if it's a cultural expectation or religious expectation or moral expectation or necessity, right? Because of the financial circumstances of the women. We do still see, you know, occupational segregation. So I mentioned it's, you know, dissipating, but it's there. And so we need to continue to push for that and get women and men to move into, you know, different job spheres that would start to level the paying field, which is the name of our podcast from our office, so we can see that gender wage gap closing. You know, we know, talk about why it persists. We know that things like education, job tenure, a full-time versus part-time work, we've talked a little bit about that, public versus private sector, unionization rates, the size of a firm, all of this kind of, you know, explains part of the gap, but it only explains about 30% of the gap. So 70% remains unexplained. And we've talked a lot about, you know, this unexplained part in professional circles. And it essentially comes down to, you know, discrimination and bias. So breaking down those stereotypes and these ideas of what women can and should do in the labor market. So I think that's where, you know, we're spending a lot of time raising awareness about this, because this is where the shift has to happen to make the next major gains.
Yeah. And, you know, education segments like this and what you do with the podcast and, you know, blogs and articles that we're sharing, these are really important too, because education means empowerment, and it means you don't have to accept the status quo out there, because you know better. And so you can educate your employer and your colleagues and your friends. So I'm so grateful that we're doing this, and that, you know, because I think a lot of people just assume that, you know, things are just going to keep going the way they're going.
Right.
But you have to participate.
I don't have to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You have to participate to change things. So this is great. Katie, as usual, great information. What are you sharing over on the Pay Equity Office website that people can go search and look for?
Well, if they want to know more about the gender wage gap in general, we have a whole really great information page there on explaining and deconstructing what the gender wage gap, you know, is and all the factors that we talked about, but in way more detail. So that's a great resource for people wanting to know more. And then, of course, they can listen to Level the Paying Field. You can find that wherever you listen to podcasts if they want to hear detailed conversations with other experts, with people from around the world also having conversations about the gender wage gap, and people from across Canada as well who are doing this work. As you said, you've got to participate and take action. And so if you want to do that, listen to the podcast and you can hear other action that's being taken and maybe sign up for something to get involved in.
Katie, as usual, thank you so much for joining me. We'll see you next month.
Thank you. Can you pay my bills? Can you pay my telephone bills? Can you pay my automobiles? Then maybe we could chill. I don't think you do. So you and me are through. More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region. Why don't you hit me with your best shot? Hit me with your best shot. Fire away.
It's time for Saturday Night at the Movies, and we've got a lot to get into this week, but let's start with the big one that we have been anticipating for months and months now.
Yeah.
Civil War. And oh, I don't know about this one. Even just watching the trailer.
I don't either. It's just such a stressor. It's about what could happen if dystopian future America when rebel factions storm the White House. Now, hello.
Yeah, exactly.
we've seen this. We have seen this, and it's a 3-hour film. And if you can take it, go see it. I have not seen it, and I likely won't see it. I just don't know if I can handle the stress of it because it's so true. What are your feelings on seeing it?
You know, it's like life imitating art, art imitating life.
Yeah.
It's a little too close to home right now, I think, for me. So I don't know. I mean, I think I'll probably watch it. I won't run to the theaters for it. I'll wait for it to arrive on streaming services. But yeah, I'm not in a rush to see it. It just feels a little too real.
Too real. And it really takes advantage of our pain right now and the pain, you know, around the world of all the discord. So anyway, maybe one day we'll both see it. But
I agree. I agree. But for those brave enough to watch it, it is out this week. There is one, though, for people who are looking for, heartwarming, heart-wrenching a little bit. Tell me about Greatest Hits.
Okay, so Lucy Boynton stars as Harriet, and she has a particular gift. She's very musically conscious, and it's like her soul operates on music. We all connect music with events or times in our lives. And it can have real significance and relevance to it. You just hear a line or two of a song and you're right back there. So with her, it's really embedded in her personality. And she develops this ability to actually go back in time to spend time with her boyfriend who is now dead and to relive those moments. She meets another fella eventually at grief group. He's lost his parents, and she describes what she goes through and what joy it gives her to go back in time to see this boyfriend based on a musical cue. So he wants to go back with her to see his parents. Now it sounds out, kind of ridiculous, but it's an emphasis of something that already is happening to us. And it's very heavy. It's talky. And we all know that music has a great pull on us. But this goes really deep into that. It's a fantasy, of course, but you wonder about people who might have a kind of ability to, like, it triggers them in ways that they can't cope. So it's kind of strangely comforting in a way. The only thing missing from the Greatest Hits is comic relief, which is so important for any film.
Noted. All right, let's move on because this next one made me giggle a little bit. Franklin, with Michael Douglas. I like Michael Douglas as an actor. However, I didn't connect with him as a period actor in this one.
My biggest complaint of Michael Douglas playing Benjamin Franklin is that he has an LA accent. I kid you not. Here he is, an 17 whatever in France, trying to accomplish this mission to get France to support the new United States against the Brits. And here he is. I mean, he might as well be saying, like, oh, you want to go to the In-N-Out Burger? It just took me out of it so much. But it really goes to a lot of effort to make it to sing his praises of polymath, writer, scientist, inventor, diplomat, printer, publisher, thinker, and great man. He was a great man. And also to remind us how the American Revolution went, and to interest people in history, which always is important. But it's the Michael Douglasness of it.
I agree. I may tune in. I don't know. I'm not in a rush to see it. What I am going to say, the next one we're talking about, I am absolutely in a rush to see it because, first off, I love anything to do with nature. And obviously, this being Earth Month, this is very important. But the narrator of this documentary, Kate Blanchett, her voice to me is so soothing.
Butter.
It is like
butter. You called it butter.
Butter. Yeah, it is beautiful. I just love her voice.
It's called Our Living World. And we've all seen documentaries of late, the last few years, that shows the interconnection of species and everything that exists, every being on the planet, how they exist in connection with one another. And I think the most easily understandable one is trees. They all are connected underground. They feed and nourish each other. They heal one another when they're wounded. But this documentary takes us under the ocean. It takes us to the remnants of forest fires, how the jaguars are crucial to existence. It's just mind-bending. And in the case of hazelnut trees, where they grow in the wild in warmer parts of the world, the squirrels bury them, all these seeds everywhere, and they forget where most of them are, which is how we get our forest. It's just the little things create the huge things, which is how we manage to stay alive. It's so important. And it's hopeful because at one point they say, even when we disrupt nature, nature fights on. So this is 4-hour-long documentaries on Netflix Discover. And I love it. And I can't wait for you to see it and get your thoughts on it.
Yeah. So out of all the ones we discussed today, that is the one that is calling me the most. So that is absolutely on my must watch this week. And you're going to have these and more up on whatshesaidtalk.com. And you'll be back next week.
I will. See you then.
As we observe Earth Month, it's crucial to confront one of the most pressing environmental issues of our time, food waste. In Canada alone, the daily disposal of millions of food items not only strains our wallets, but also has a profound impact on our planet. From the energy expended in production and transportation to the detrimental effects on landfills, the cycle of waste is a problem we can no longer afford to ignore. Today, I'm joined by Punita Chitwal Varma, author of the upcoming book, Good Food, Healthy Planet, to explore practical solutions to this pervasive issue and discover how small changes in our daily habits can lead to significant environmental benefits. Welcome back to What She Said, Punita.
Hello, Candace. How are you? Thank you for having me back.
It's my pleasure. I'm so glad you're back because I know this very subject is so near and dear to your heart. Can you share more about the environmental and economic impact of this waste, particularly in the context of our current economy?
Well, food waste is such a big problem. And as you rightly point out, it's more than just the lettuce heads and the tomatoes that we see, right? It's about what goes on behind the scenes, the land, the soil, the time, the energy, the oil and gas that it takes to schlep our tomatoes from farms to distribution houses to packaging and then to our grocery stores, to our homes, refrigerators. And guess what? We throw away more than half the food that we grow and raise and produce. Like in Canada and the US, the problem is monumental.
Yeah. And, you know, I think for a long time, we were just so used to this massive surplus of food and cheap prices and you know, just so much. We had so much. We weren't thinking about it. And I started to really think about, in my house, for example, I would buy those containers of spinach. And oftentimes, I wouldn't get to the spinach in time. It would rot. And then when I started to think about the life cycle of that, it really, really hit home. You know, because that spinach had to be grown from seed, picked, put into this package, transported thousands of kilometers to my grocery store where people would put it on the shelves. Then I took it home to basically rot and throw in the garbage.
Absolutely.
And when you think about it that way, it changes everything.
Yes, because it's often what's behind the scenes that if we knew, and so many of us are now opening our eyes to this, to the enormity of the problem, right? And if we knew how much time, effort, gas, soil, land, and everything else that goes into growing and raising our food, we would treat it with more care. But I have to say right off the bat here that it's not all on us, right? Because it can seem really overwhelming and it feels like another thing on this list of things to do. I'm a mom, I'm a cooker and an eater at home, and it feels like, oh my God, don't give me one more job, right, to treat my food better than I do. And it feels really judgy because it's not all on us. That's what I'm getting at. Of course, personal steps is where we all begin, because it often all begins with our own practices at home, but it's also the grocery stores and the industry and the food system that we all need to change. And I see so many stakeholders out there doing their part that it's wonderful to see the change that's coming, but we need more change faster if we're making a dent in the enormous problem of food waste.
Absolutely. And aside from the environment, you know, we just think about how many people are actually hungry in Canada at this very moment who don't have easy access to food. There's a multi, or, you know, taking your money and lighting it on fire every time you throw something out. No matter how you look at it, everybody has their own personal reason to reduce their waste. So can you share some simple actionable tips that individuals and families can take to reduce their food waste?
Yes, for sure. I mean, personal steps, there's so many and I could go on and on. My favorite ones right now is tea towels. Like, I love tea towels, and not the new pretty Instagram worthy ones. I have ones that are stained and messy, clean, washed regularly, but the stains never come out, right? And most of my produce that I bring in every week, every Sunday, I bring in, my fruits and veg. I wash them in. So I have a practice. I have a routine. I don't get to it each Sunday, every Sunday. But if I can get to it most of the time, it helps simplify my routine during the week. And so what I do is I often come home, dunk everything in the sink, let it rinse, wash, and then I wrap it in tea towels and put it in the fridge straight away. Anything that is big and voluminous, like your chard and collard greens, anything that takes up a lot of space in the fridge, I actually wash, rinse, and then I saute it so it reduces down really quickly. And then I can store it cooked in the fridge. And that way I know on that Thursday night when things are crazy and the kids need to be fed, I need to be fed. There is some cooked greens that I can add to a bowl of rice and dinner is ready, right? It needs to be practical, simple, and doable for most of us just living our lives doing our work, raising our kids, it needs to be doable.
And there are certain foods that tend to get wasted more. Mm. I mean, obviously, this is anecdotal, I feel, but I feel like everybody struggles with this. Avocados, which are notorious for not being ripe, and then you got a one-day window to eat them. You know, bananas and lettuce, you know, lettuce, spinach, those things that, like I said, come in those containers. Any tips for extending the life of those or storing them properly?
So avocados, my big tip, remember that they can be cooked as well, right? My kids, we often think about avocado mash and guac. Those are the two things that are most popular with people. But once they're a little overripe and even a little bit, you know, if they've gone brown, they feel like a mash is not the right way. And so I often slice, pan fry, and then cook with something crunchy and add some lime juice, so sesame seeds and lime juice. And layer it on toast. Like cooked avocado is delicious. And you can
use that.
Oh, try it and let me know how it goes with you. And lettuce is such a resource intensive vegetable that it hurts when we have to throw it away, right? It uses a lot of water. It's water intensive, resource intensive, and it turns to slime so quickly. But if we can remember, lettuce cooks too. It cooks beautifully. Lettuce soup. Little bit of garlic, black pepper, olive oil, saute it all together, and then add water or milk or cream if you have some in the fridge. That's a delicious meal, again, on a Thursday night. Thursday night is my crazy night, so I'm always glad to have these little tips and hacks how I can clean out the fridge and also make dinner, right?
Can you tell me about your squelchy potatoes?
I know we talked about that briefly. So this is a story about potatoes that happened last year after March break. We went away on a last minute trip, traveled around, came back, and I opened my pantry and the stink. I had left a half bag of potatoes in my pantry. The potatoes had kind of cooked down. They were black and squelchy. I mean, there is no other word, squelchy potatoes. And I, you know, we call it hit the ground running. I had work next day at 7 a.m. So what I did, it was the end of March. So the soil outside, like I have a bunch of containers with old soil in it. And it had warmed up. So Canada, Toronto weather, it was maybe about 10 degrees, so not really spring yet. And so I dunked the entire half bag of squelchy, black, stinky potatoes in a container of soil, and I pressed them down, and I walked away for 2 weeks, lived my life, and that summer, we had new potatoes. Those squelchy potatoes had become food for a harvest of maybe 40, 50 new potatoes that I had. I have a photo on Instagram somewhere from a year ago. That was wonderful, right? Squelch into something delicious.
I love it. And especially now that gardening season is just about to start, that's good timing for this. We're all at different parts of this journey, obviously, of learning how to reduce waste and get more efficient in our kitchen. And you are much further along than most. So how can people start making a difference without feeling overwhelmed? Because I think, you know, as you mentioned, we are really busy in this society. We have multiple roles, multiple things to do. So how can we sort of implement these changes without feeling overwhelmed and maybe a little bit resentful about it?
I get it. I mean, I talk about this in my book, but it can feel overwhelming because there is so much doom and gloom in our feed, right? And rightfully so. I mean, soon enough, there's going to be wildfires and the news around climate change will become heavier. I feel winter time, we have a little bit of a gap because the air quality is lovely and the wildfires have quietened. But what I will say is that start wherever you are. There are people who are further ahead, like my mom, for example, is much further ahead on this journey of low waste than I am. And then there are other people who are perhaps with me and other people who are maybe a couple of chess squares further back. And that's okay. We are all handling our lives, living our lives in the way that we know best. And there is absolutely no judgment. We all need to do something. And it's not enough to do small steps anymore. We all need to make big change. But that big change can look differently for everybody. And that's okay.
Excellent. You're going to be back the end of this month because we're going to be talking about your book.
Yes, we are.
In the meantime, I'm so excited for this book, actually. In the meantime, though, people want me to embark on this journey right away today, this very instant. Where do they go to find you and get tips for helping them along the way?
I have a bunch of videos on Instagram that they can start with. I mean, a lot of us start with Instagram videos. So I'm at Mabel and Marigold. You can also have a look at my blog, mabelandmarigold.com, and pre-order my book. Why don't you? There's tons of tips in there.
All right. Excellent. Punita, we'll see you soon. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
The allure of fast fashion is undeniable, but it's countered by a devastating impact on both people and the planet, making the quest for sustainable yet stylish clothing more critical than ever. Enter Oraki, a brand that stands at the intersection of eco-conscious manufacturing and high-quality apparel. Founded by Cynthia Savard, Oraki is a testament to the power of combining passion with purpose. With a commitment to using recycled fibers and natural plant fibers, Oraki not only offers a sustainable alternative, but also challenges the industry's status quo. Today, I'm joined by Cynthia for a closer look at the world of eco-fashion, the innovative fabrics behind Oraki, and the importance of authenticity in the fight against greenwashing. Welcome to What She Said, Cynthia.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Oraki is known for its unique fabrics like EcoMove and EcoFlex. So can you walk us through the research and development process that led you to these sustainable materials?
Oh my God, yes. But the whole story will take 2 days, but I'm gonna make it quick. Basically, I'm a fashion designer for more than 20 years now, and developing fabric has been something I've always done, and this is my passion. Before even designing clothing, making fabrics is really my passion. So I work closely with many manufacturers, even before I launched my own brand to make fabrics. I was looking to have a fabric that was made from recycled yarns. And at that time, it was very hard because, like, let's say 10 years ago, that was not like as now. You know, now it's very easy to get into manufacture and get recycled fabric, all type of recycling fabrics. But back then it was very hard. Like, I couldn't find exactly what I was looking for. So we did so many tests for 2 years. I've tested many different fabrics, many different manufacturers, different people. And I was very discouraged many times. I was discouraged and I didn't want to follow up with this project. But yes, I didn't give up. And one day I just asked again to make some change and use other kind of recycled fabrics. And I was working with Reprieve also at that time. I'm still working with them. Yes, we finally got what I was looking for. That was in 2020. Well, I had other fabric before, but the EcoMove, it was in 2020.
And I imagine that the eco-fashion space comes with its own set of challenges and opportunities. What has been your experience in shaping Oraki within the Canadian market? And how do you navigate the balance between sustainability and style?
Thank you for asking. Basically, I'm also like a vegan. I've been a vegetarian for 25 years. It's been a long time. So to me, to make this brand sustainable, it was part of my journey. It was part of who I am. I have to say that back then it was kind of, I was new. I was new to it. I was kind of a pioneer. So it was easy for me in the beginning to enter this market and have this type of product. to offer to the client. But I have to say that many people didn't believe us at the beginning. Many people didn't believe that we could make, fabrics or clothing made from recycled plastic bottles. Like back then, it was not known. So we had so much hate on the Facebook, Instagram. No, this is not true. This is not possible. So we have to prove everybody's wrong.
And I think that's because we've become so skeptical because there's been this massive rise of greenwashing. Consumers are, we're tired and we're exhausted from having to investigate every brand we purchase from. So how does Oraki ensure transparency and authenticity in its sustainability claims?
I think that when you look on our website, you can see we are very transparent. This is like our first values that we put on the table. Also, what we do is we have all the certifications that we need when you do like recycle yarn or you work with the manufacturer. The second very big point is that everything is made here in Canada. So we are in the manufacturer. You can see us there with the makers, with the manufacturer owners. So there's nothing to lie or there's nothing to be, afraid of. I'm there. So you can, and we show everything on Instagram. We show everything on Facebook. Everybody can, follow our journey also. So yes, we are very transparent.
You hit a lot of the things that I look for in a company. Sustainability is huge. I love that. Canadian, but also you're really building an amazing community that empowers women. So, this is right up what she said, Zali. So can you share more about the initiatives Oraki has undertaken to support and uplift women?
Yes. To be completely honest, this is even a side I was not even thinking when I launched Oraki. I try to reach as many women as I can, but I never thought that we had so many women loving our product and following us. And it turns to something even bigger than I ever imagined. To us, like sharing a message that is very strong and powerful and, to women, like especially let's say inside our leggings, we also have like a very, as I can say, like we have coats, but they are like cheerful. It helps every woman that buys the leggings. Every legging has a name. Every legging has a coat. It's very inspiring for them during the day to see the coats. We have so many beautiful messages that say that, oh, I'm going for this cancer treatment and I'm wearing this legging. And I saw the coat in the morning and, it gave me the force to go. And, even saying that right now, I have chills like telling you, but this is like the best thing for me. And the women, we also, we support them, all of the shape, all the nationality. It's very important to have like diversity in all our business. And also we partner with many other companies such as SOS Violence that is taking care of the woman with domestic violence. I'm sorry, I'm French. I'm trying my best. But yes,
you're doing better than I would be doing in French.
French, English. We support many cause like that that's close to our heart. Every year we sit down with our team and we ask ourselves, okay, what cause that we can, we can join it this year, and we make sure that through the year we help like causes as much as we can.
You're at the forefront of the eco-fashion movement. So where do you see the industry heading in the next few years? And what role will Oraki play in shaping that future?
I think our role, first of all, is to make clothing that lasts. I wouldn't say that I follow trends. I have to sometimes, but we do clothes that will last, that will, be good in 3 years, in 5 years, in 10 years. We do a lot of black, a lot of grays, a lot of colors that will last. Our goal is to have garments that stay for a long time, that everybody can wear them in many occasions as well. Yeah.
So for consumers looking to make sustainable fashion choices, do you have any tips and advice outside of obviously shopping at Oraki? What else can consumers do, sort of to push back against this fast fashion disaster?
Well, they can look first where the clothes are made. And what are they made from? Hopefully, the website, they show a transparency page where everything is announced as us. Everything is written. We don't have nothing to hide. This is the best thing to look at. I think that the less you consume, the better it is. And you just have to make better choice. Think about the future and like, do you really need that? Honestly, when you think about it, how many hoodies do you have? Do you need that one?
You know, this is interesting talking to you because this really does go against the way businesses operate, where they push more, more, more. You're saying less, less, less.
Well, this is how we made our business, to be honest with you. Everything is, we do very small quantities. So let's say I buy like a lot of fabric. When the lot is finished, it's finished. So like I move on to the next thing. It's very hard. It's not all the time that we do like a repeat orders on styles. If the style is good, well, then good for the people that has it. I'm not going to do it again. So that's how we do it.
Where can people find Orchid? Are you only online or can people find you in physical locations as well?
We do a lot of pop-ups and events around Montreal, Quebec also. We did Toronto not too long ago. We are also traveling Vancouver and all places in Canada. But yes, it's honestly on our website, oraki.ca.
All right, fantastic. And what are your social channels?
It's oraki.ca also on Facebook and Instagram.
So I just want to let people know that we're going to be doing a giveaway for a $200 gift certificate to Orchid. So to watch What She Said Talk Instagram for that, because I want to get as many people turned on to this company as possible. The clothes are beautiful and meant to last. So thank you, Cynthia, for joining me, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
In a country as progressive as Canada, you would think that gender equality would be a given by now. Yet the reality tells a different story, with women and gender-diverse individuals facing significant barriers and inequalities that span from the workplace to the most intimate areas of their lives. The Canadian Women's Foundation Count Me In initiative shines a spotlight on these issues, calling for urgent action to bridge the gaps in gender equality. Today, I'm joined by Suzanne Duncan, Vice President of Philanthropy at the Canadian Women's Foundation, to discuss this pivotal movement and how each of us can play a role in fostering a more equitable society. Welcome to What She Said, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Could you give us an overview of the Count Me In initiative and what prompted the Canadian Women's Foundation to launch this campaign at this particular time?
Yeah, you know, this time is really important. So we know right now that women and gender diverse people, you know, we're half of Canada's population, yet we continue to face gender gaps and inequality. We know there's underrepresentation in political leadership and professional leadership. There's increased risk of intimate partner violence, sexual assault. These are things that are really growing over the last couple of years. There's still gender pay gaps. There's so many barriers that women and gender diverse people in Canada face. And we also know that these gaps are worse for Black, Indigenous, and racialized women, for women with disabilities, for those who are marginalized. And we really need to take a moment and use this moment where so many folks are feeling very anxious and worried about what their lives are going to look like and what barriers they're still facing. And we wanted to be able to have a place where we come together and really think about how we can collectively raise our voices and really ignite the need for public action around gender inequality. So starting on March 18th, we launched this Count Me In campaign, which features a beautiful video done by director Kat Weber, who's known for her wonderful collaborative storytelling. It's brought in some really great people who are really rallying against those systemic gender-based inequalities and injustices across Canada. And this film and this campaign is a call to action. It's a visual petition that brings together people in Canada who want to count themselves in for gender equality, who want to be heard, and who want to use their voices to empower others as well. We've got more than 65,000 people have joined so far, and we're wanting even more. We want to have, you know, thousands of Canadians say, yes, count me in. Count me in to say that gender equality matters, especially at a time when we're worried about how these inequalities are playing out in people's lives.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned anxiousness, and I feel that on a daily basis, you know, just through the conversations I have with women across the country. The Count Me In film features a diverse group of feminists from across Canada. What message do you hope this film conveys to its viewers, and what impact has it had since its debut?
Mm-hmm. I think the message that we're really wanting to really get out there is we matter. And these inequalities are holding back our country. And these inequalities are holding back people's lives. And in a time where we are faced with record on affordability, housing challenges, rising violence, all of these things, we wanted to have a place where people could feel and know that their opinions matter. You know, sometimes I look at the headlines and the news and I see like, this isn't really representing those stories that I'm hearing every day, like you, from women who are really struggling. And we wanted to make sure that, you know, we have had times in the past couple of years where there's been a lot of attention on how inequality is playing out, you know, whether that's around childcare, whether that's around how women were impacted by the pandemic. But it feels like some of that momentum has dissipated. And that doesn't mean that those needs are gone or that those worries are gone or that those concrete actions aren't important. So this is really a chance for people who are feeling not heard to be able to be heard. And we are seeing, you know, as I mentioned, with 65,000 people so far and counting, and this is not a one-time thing. We're going to be doing this for the next year or two to continue to bring those voices together and to have a whole base of people who feel more equipped to be able to advocate for the change that they need.
How does the Count Me In initiative aim to address the unique challenges faced by Black, Indigenous, and other racialized women, women with disabilities, and then, of course, all those in the 2SLGBTQIA community?
Yeah, I think it's really important. At the Canadian Women's Foundation, we've been around for about 35 years, and we're guided by a sort of sentence given to us by one of our founding mothers, who's Rosemary Brown, was the first Black woman who got elected to a provincial legislature. And she said, until all of us have made it, none of us have made it. And that collectiveness, thinking about not just how am I impacted, but how are racialized women impacted? For folks who are new to Canada, for folks who are living with disabilities, they are often not represented. And we want to make sure that every person who is experiencing these gender inequalities feels like their voice matters and is seen by decision makers. And we believe that the Canadian Women's Foundation, who, you know, we are right now funding programs that are focused on those who have been most left out of mainstream conversation. So focusing on grassroots charities that have the tools and the expertise to create those real change in their communities. Part of Count Me In is about raising those voices, and part of Count Me In is about rallying support to those organizations that are on the front lines doing that important work, helping women and gender diverse people launch new businesses, helping make sure that they're safe from violence, helping make sure that young people have the tools that they need to be able to have healthy relationships, and making sure that girls and other young people are really inspired into leadership and into confidence. So being the Canadian Women's Foundation, we're a great space to be able to help amplify those voices. And not just amplify, but be led by the voices of people who are being, you know, not addressed and not heard. And that's part of what that idea behind Count Me In is that, you know, we know that 10% of women in Canada are living on low incomes, and those folks are more likely to be racialized. They're more likely to be older. They're more likely to be single moms. They're more likely to be living with disabilities. We need to make sure that those issues are prioritized as we are thinking about the kinds of changes we need as a country.
So as you've alluded to, this is a real call to action. It's not just a film. So what are some ways individuals can get involved and support the movement towards a more equitable future?
Yeah, I think go to yescountmein.ca. So yescountmein, all one word, .ca. And that's where you can sign up to be counted in. Once you do that, you will then be part of a whole conversation around what kind of change can you make in your community? How do you identify your strengths, your abilities, the things that you can do to help create change in your community and across the country? So really equipping people with some of those tools and having opportunities to bring everyone together through the year to hear and be inspired about some of those changes and learn more about what they can do in their own, you know, in their own backyard.
So you've mentioned the website. Where are there special social channels for this, or is it all through the Canadian Women's Foundation?
The easiest place to start is just, you know, Canadian Women's Foundation. So you'll see that front center on our website. If you see an ad, whether you're online or out there, you can also go to yescountmein.ca. Those are the things that are really going to get you to the space that you need to be part of this great movement.
And outside of the film, are there any other supporting materials people can access, you know, workbooks, workshops, yeah, things like that?
Those will be coming through the year as we get more and more folks involved. But as I said, when you sign up right now, you'll be part of an email series that includes some really great tools for you as a person. So, you know, there's a wonderful opportunity to learn which kind of change maker you are, kind of take a bit of a survey and see where you can really affect change in your community and within your families, within your workplaces. And as the year rolls out, we'll have lots of opportunities for people to get more engaged and to support the things that they care about, to support those local changes happening in their community.
Fantastic. I can't thank you enough for joining me. Of course, I love the Canadian Women's Foundation. You're always welcome on the show. But Count Me In sounds really unique and special. So thank you for joining me today to shine a spotlight on it.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That's it for What She Said this week. Stay up to date with our newsletter by signing up at whatshesaidtalk.com and be sure to follow on social at What She Said Talk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for videos of these interviews and more. You can also catch me on TikTok at Candace Said. Finally, be sure to subscribe to What She Said with Candace Sampson on Apple and Spotify to catch past episodes and extended podcasts. I'll be back next week with another What She Said on 105.9 The Region.
We want to welcome you to the Beyonce Cowboy Carter Act 2 in a rodeo chillin' circuit. We're gonna make it do what it do, yeah, yeah. Put them hands together. We clapping.
Previous episodes of What She Said on 105.9theregion.com.